This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. We begin today's program with a story that has roots in Boston and in Northern Ireland and spans from the 1960s and 70s through today. This afternoon, the leader of the political organization Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, is behind bars. Adams was arrested in connection with the abduction and murder of a mother of 10 in Belfast in 1972. It happened during the heat of the so-called Troubles. That's when there were brutal clashes between those who wanted to keep Northern Ireland under British rule and those who wanted it to be independent. Gerry Adams was fighting for independence.
The politician is being questioned in prison about the notorious death of a woman named Jean McConville. Gerry Adams was taken into custody yesterday by Northern Irish police, and the IRA at one time believed McConville was an informant.
Jean McConville had 10 children. Several of them were with her on that day in December of 1972. One of them was Michael. He was 11 years old. He recalls about a dozen men coming to the house. He even recognized some of them from the neighborhood. The children cried and clung to their mom. The men said that they were merely going to question her, and they took her away. Her body wasn't found for another 30 years.
It's logical to wonder why young Michael and his siblings never told police who abducted their mother. Michael McConville has a ready answer. About a week after his mother was kidnapped, he was walking to the home of his grandmother, and something happened to him.
I was going to my grandmother's house. The IRA grabbed me, stuck a hood over my head. It was a sleeve of a woolly jumper. When they pulled it down, I could see through it. They brought me down the stairwell. They brought me to a house. They tied me to a chair, and they beat me with sticks, and they put a gun to my head, and they were threatening to shoot me. They said they were going to shoot me if I told anything about any members of the IRA. And this went on for about 3 hours, and at the end of it, they said they were going to shoot me, and they fired a cap gun and stuck a penny from my leg.
The men eventually let him go. And again, Michael was 11 years old at the time. And even today, more than 40 years later, he and his siblings won't reveal who abducted their mother and threatened them. If they talk, Michael's convinced they'll be shot.
Gerry Adams has long denied any involvement in Jean McConville's murder. He did so again last night as he approached the police station to turn himself in.
I'm innocent totally of any part in the abduction, the killing, or the burial of Jean McConville.
Gerry Adams speaking to the Irish broadcaster RTE. Now, this development is a direct result of research that comes from Boston College. The Boston College Belfast Project consists of a series of candid oral testimonies given by paramilitary members, people involved in the violent fight to free Northern Ireland from British rule. The college wanted to keep them private, keep the oral histories private, until the people testifying had died. But the United States Justice Department ordered them to be made public last year.
Joining us now from Belfast in Northern Ireland is journalist Henry MacDonald. He's been reporting on these developments for the Guardian newspaper, where he is a Belfast correspondent. Welcome to Radio Boston, Henry.
Hi there.
I wonder if you could tell us why this particular murder of this woman, Jean McConville, back in 1972, is still haunting Gerry Adams.
Well, because of firstly, I'm the Ireland correspondent, not just the Belfast correspondent, but the allegations swirl around Mr. Adams from former comrades in the IRA and Sinn Féin. He says he wasn't in the IRA, but the Republican movement in general. They say he came up with the idea of a secret IRA unit that would be used to smoke out, weed out informers within the nationalist Catholic community in Belfast at that early phase of the Troubles in the 1970s. They allege that he came up with the idea of disappearing Jean McConville because of the negative publicity that it would bring upon the Republican cause, you know, killing a woman who was a widow, who had 10 children, who was formerly a Protestant who converted to Catholicism. You know, it was much more politically convenient to disappear her. They actually put out a legend that she had ran away with a British soldier, and a lot of people believed that for decades. And Mr. Adams has always denied that, but these allegations keep surfacing, and they keep surfacing from his own camp, from former friends, former comrades. So that's why this thing has dogged him for for at least 2 decades.
And in terms of why right now he is behind bars, which he is at this moment, to what extent are the Boston College tapes that we mentioned in the introduction, these tapes, oral histories that have included much detailed information about what happened during the Troubles, to what extent are they responsible for Gerry Adams turning himself in and now being held in custody?
Couple of points of clarification. He's not behind bars. He's voluntarily in a police station, although he is in custody.
Was he arrested?
Well, he was arrested. There's kind of a fog of confusion about this here, but the thing is that he went to the solicitor to the police station because he knew he was pending being arrested if he was in Northern Ireland. So that's the reality of the situation. As for the Boston tapes, the archive, well, they played a pretty critical role in all this because the testimony of both posthumous testimony, dead IRA members, like, for example, a former friend of Gerry Adams, Brendan Hughes, ex-IRA hunger striker, ex-commander of the organization in Belfast, and others, I understand it could be up to 10 others, have made some references to the McConville killing and abduction and disappearance in their overall oral history testimonies about their time in the IRA. So it's quite a voluminous amount of material. Now, whether or not it amounts to evidence in a court of law is another matter. Let me just make one clarification as well, which is really, really important, and it's this. Michael McConville says, yes, he was too afraid at the time, and who the hell could blame him about naming names about those who broke into his house and seized his mother. And he says that still pertains today, but that's not true of all the McConville siblings. Tomorrow in the Guardian newspaper, the oldest girl in the family, Helen, now Helen McKendry, she's a grandmother now herself, she says, quite bluntly and quite plainly to us, she would be prepared to stand up in court and name names.
Do you think if she does name names, this is one of the older sisters of Michael McConville?
The oldest.
The oldest. So she was how old at the time?
Oh, she was, what, 15?
So presumably she would have an even better recognition of some of these people than an 11-year-old.
Yes.
Michael says, look, if we came forth, I am convinced even today that I would be shot. And one of the reasons he says that is that he knows, or he says that during the ceasefire with the IRA, that there were still arms coming in from the United States
to be used by
the IRA. So from Florida, you say. So in that case, do you think that his oldest sister has any reason to believe that her life would be in danger as she comes out, apparently, as you say, in your newspaper tomorrow?
Well, what she said to me, and she said it before privately to me, because I've known her for 2 decades since the campaign began, that, you know, she spent the first half of her life in total fear and in silence, and she now no longer cares. She says, what are they going to do, come and shoot me? I mean, they're meant to be off the field. They're meant to be off the pitch, the IRA. They're not meant to be around. So I don't think she really cares at this stage. She's prepared to do that. But that begs the question, will there be a court case, a criminal court case? And, you know, there's some people casting doubt over whether or not the Boston tapes alone would be evidential, would be enough to put up a criminal trial. But I can tell you as well, what's for sure is this. If there is no criminal prosecution of Gerry Adams, the Helen McKendry and her supporters are considering a civil legal action. This is different from a criminal trial, obviously. And they have models on which to base that on.
I clarify that again. Legal action against whom?
Well, against Gerry Adams, it would be a civil action, which would be basically they would sue him in court for, you know, whatever alleged role he played in this whole policy of the disappearing these alleged informers. And now, this was done before. A group of families of the Oma bomb atrocity, you may remember back in 1998.
These are school children who
lots of people. 29 people were killed in that bomb. And some of the relatives sued in Belfast High Court. Men, they alleged, were the leaders of this breakaway IRA group, the real IRA, and they sued them and they won in court, and there's still a case in terms of the damages that they sued these people for. You know, it's still gone all the way to the European Court of Human Rights, but nonetheless, it was a big trial, lots of exposure, lots of truth came out. So what I'm saying is that even if the police say no charges and there's no chance of a prosecution in a criminal court of law, this issue, this controversy, is far from over, and it may still therefore bring into play the Boston tapes and the testimony contained within the Belfast Project as evidence in a civil trial.
Henry, briefly, one final question. To what extent does the apprehension of Gerry Adams right now and these continuing questions and accusations that you mention, to what extent do they potentially have a bearing, a negative bearing, on the peace process and on the current unified government?
Well, there's certainly a souring of relations, and Martin McGuinness is quite critical about what he called were certain forces within the police in Northern Ireland who wanted to, who were behind this arrest. However, he was quite careful to say that there were other forces within the police who were much more reform-minded in his eyes. That, to me, is an indicator that he doesn't want to pull this whole edifice of power sharing down, including support in general for the police in Northern Ireland, the new policing service. So my guess is this is a lot of turbulence, a lot of shaking and uncertainty. But in the end, I think the settlement and the political kind of power-sharing arrangement is quite complicated, but keeps the two communities in power equally, will continue. That's my guess.
Okay, thank you. Henry McDonald, the Ireland correspondent for The Guardian newspaper, speaking to us from Belfast. Thank you. Among the interviews that are part of the Belfast Project that we've been mentioning at Boston College was an interview with a former IRA commander, Brendan Hughes, which was featured in the award-winning 2008 documentary called Voices from the Grave. This tape right now begins with the voice of one of the interviewers.
Do you have a problem with committing all this to a secret tape to be used only after you have died?
I don't have a problem with that. If I did have a problem with that, I wouldn't be sitting here talking into the microphone. I think a lot of the stuff that I'm saying here, I'm saying it in trust because I have a trust in you. And I have never, ever, ever admitted being a member of the IRA. Never. I've just done it here.
The interview with Brendan Hughes was released just after his death in 2006. One of the people who conducted the interviews for Boston College as part of this oral history project is Anthony McIntyre. He is a former member of the Provisional IRA. He has spent time in prison himself. He left the Provisional IRA after the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. He's also conducted many of the interviews in this Belfast project. Anthony, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me on.
I wonder if you could tell us first what your reaction is to the arrest of Gerry Adams and to what extent you think this arrest is tied to the oral history project which you helped conduct.
Well, the sequence of events would suggest that it's very much linked to the oral history project. There have been a series of arrests, and one person has been charged, a former close colleague of Gerry Adams, so one has to presume without actually knowing factually that it's linked to the Boston College project. I'm deeply disappointed and angry at the arrest of Mr. Adams. I think there's a large political motivation here on the part of the PSNI. I have throughout the day pointed out to media outlets that the day prior to Mr. Adams' arrest, the British state turned down, actually slapped down a demand for an inquiry into British Army behaviour in Ballymurphy, the neighbourhood Mr. Adams grew up in and lived in at the time of the massacre in 1971. There was a massacre and the British carried out by the British Army, and the British government slapped down a demand for an inquiry. The following day, they arrest Mr. Adams in pursuit of an inquiry into Republican activity. So it is a politically loaded case, and it is the result of political policing.
When you mention the PSNI, that's the Police Service of Northern Ireland. The Police Service of Northern Ireland had said that it wanted to question you as well over the newest releases in the Belfast Project recordings, some of those recordings you conducted yourself. Did they speak with you?
No, they haven't spoken with me, and I won't be speaking with them. It doesn't matter where they manage to get their hands on me. I will not be speaking with them. I will not be cooperating with them. I will assist them in no way whatsoever.
Is there not a price to be paid for that?
There may well be, but if academics and researchers, journalists, historians do not stand up and are willing to pay this price, there will never be any research. All we will have in terms of a historical overview will be a law enforcement view, a scenes of crime perspective. That's absolutely self-serving, limiting, and will enhance public understanding in no meaningful way whatsoever. So journalists and researchers must be willing to pay that price and not under any circumstances do anything that will enable law enforcement to use research gathered in a research setting for the purposes of law enforcement. There are two separate fields of knowledge procurement. One is research for public, the enhancement of public understanding. The other is investigation for evidence in the criminal justice system. I don't think the two should meet. I think we have to have a plurality of information gathering services for the benefit of society, and we should not have some paramilitary-type structure whereby law enforcement trumps everything else and sits at the top.
This very much echoes the sentiments of Boston College itself. We spoke, in fact, earlier today to BC spokesman Jack Dunn about the issue of whether or not the release of information like this, testimony that was supposed to be held, at least that was the understanding with those who were giving the testimony itself, held until their death. That was not the case because of a Justice Department ruling. Let's see what Jack Dunn had to say.
Clearly, this could have a chilling effect on oral history projects. The reality is any country with which the United States has a mutual legal assistance treaty runs a risk of having any oral history project subpoenaed as a result of the actions of the police services of Northern Ireland.
Do you believe that there has indeed been a chilling effect on oral history projects? Are people less likely to talk to someone like you about their experiences now?
Well, firstly, I would like to say that Jack Dunn's correct, but I mean, Jack Dunn and Boston College should have told people from the very outset about the existence of the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, and Jack Dunn and the college could have made it very clear that this existed. In fact, they said that there was no circumstances under which the British state could procure this information. They seemed not to know anything about the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty. After the first subpoena was issued, I warned the college that it was necessary to either get rid of the archive or to hand it over to my custody, my control, so that I would be able to safeguard it. It was an endangered archive at that time. Boston College said that they had been informed by people formerly schooled in international law that there would not be a second subpoena. It was nonsense.
Anthony McIntyre, let me just interrupt for 1 second, because Jack Dunn apparently also says that they knew of the existence of this mutual legal assistance treaty. They did not anticipate this would be the outcome. But I want to ask you about something else.
I'm very concerned about this, because if Jack Dunn and Boston College knew about this, they had an obligation, a moral and ethical obligation, to tell the researchers and the research participants. They withheld that information from them. I think this is a damning statement by Jack Dunn, a damning indictment of Boston College's behavior in this matter.
We should say also that both of you were on the same side in terms of arguing against the release of these tapes. We can leave the rest of that argument for another time. Anthony, I need to ask you this, though. We just heard from a reporter in Ireland that there is going to be in Northern Ireland, there's going to be testimony released from one of Jean McConville, the woman who was murdered, from one of her children, the oldest daughter, tomorrow. Testimony about what she saw, about who came into her house, what members of the IRA she believes were responsible for abducting her mother. Do you fear, from what you know, of fear for her safety when she comes out with information like this?
I have to fear for her safety. I know what a vicious, violent, and virulent organization the Provisional Movement is underneath the veneer of the peace process. I was a member of that movement for many years. I know that the smear campaign at the minute, been organized by people like Martin McGuinness and Danny Morrison and others, is upping the tempo and creating an atmosphere whereby people like Helen McCandrew, who may decide to reveal what she knows, it's upping the ante and creating an atmosphere in which, she could very well be in danger. Myself and Ed Maloney have insisted from the outset that that there is a possibility of danger to people like myself and also people who were research participants.
Ed Maloney being one of the other archivists.
Pardon?
Ed Maloney being one of the other archivists. Do you understand,
Ed Maloney...
Yes.
He was the project director. But I don't see in any way what Helen's testimony will, what impact it will have on Jerry Adams whatsoever. I doubt very much if I would be very, very surprised if Helen McConville was to say, or Helen McCandy was to say, that Gerry Adams came into her house. I simply would not countenance that that happened.
Anthony, very briefly, do you understand how this is not over, even with any of the guarantees that were made for those doing the testifying, how this is not over for the families of the victims, that once this information has been released, they feel the need to find closure on what happened in their own family?
I think that the victims have every right to find closure. I think the victims of the British state, the victims of the IRA, the victims of the Loyalists, the victims of the RUC, the victims across the whole range of political violence in the north of Ireland have a right to find answers. The problem is that they're not going to find answers if they go down a road of justice through retribution. If they seek justice through revelation, they will get a hell of a lot more answers than they're ever going to get in courts.
Thank you. Anthony McIntyre, former member of the Provisional IRA, who conducted many of the interviews for Boston College's Belfast Project. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Well, stay with us, because coming up, a collection of stories and essays published posthumously by the parents of an incredibly promising young writer. The collection is called The Opposite of Loneliness. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Radio Boston.